Welcome to Tales from the Waystone, a Kingkiller Chronicle reread podcast.
We are your hosts, Will and Phoenix. Let's get into it.
Welcome to Tales from the Waystone, Season 2, Episode 60, Line Doesn't Always Go Up, where we will be looking at chapters 122 and 123 of The Wise Man's Fear through the lens of nonlinear progression.
If you're new here, we just ended on page 900 of the second book of the series and more than 4 years in. But welcome, a little explanation of the pod. Each week, we will be examining a section of The Wise Man's Fear through a chosen lens and figuring out what we can take from the text and apply to our real lives. We will also take time to focus on a phronemos of the week and then share a recommended thing of the week. Finally, we will wrap things up with 7 words from the book and 7 words from our own lives. Before we begin, let's get some disclaimers out of the way. First of all, we are in no way affiliated with Patrick Roth with Source Publisher Books. Second, our discussions naturally assume that either you have read all of the works of Patrick Rothfuss, or you don't care about spoilers, or both. Anyway, I just need to let y'all know, here be spoilers. Also, a word to our community, please be kind to yourselves and one another and the creators of the world that we love exploring.
All right. So with that, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about nonlinear progression. I think oftentimes in narratives, it is very tempting to assume that our characters will make just progress after progress after progress. Like, once they succeed, they will not fail.
Or they won't fail in the same way again.
But I don't think that actually fits with any actual real person's path through life. Even when you are doing the thing that you've put in your 10,000 hours or whatever into, the thing you've supposedly mastered, there's still room for mistakes and you are still going to make mistakes. You're not always going to do the optimal thing every time. You're gonna continue to learn and grow. And when we look at progress from a sociopolitical perspective, you know, while if you were to take our general legal status now compared to, say, the 1800s, we'd definitely say that, yeah, it's a lot better than it was. There isn't really just a direct line where it just was continually getting better and better and better. There were highs and lows all in between all of that. And there's regression and backsliding along the way. And any progress that happens is because people have basically decided to pick themselves up proverbially and keep going. There's always room for setbacks. There's always going to be things that prevent us from getting to where we want to go as individuals, as communities, as overall societies. So in that regard, I think it goes more than just, okay, you have a training montage and now you're good. You're going to make mistakes. Some of those mistakes can be catastrophic. These are mistakes that no one is immune to. People performing at the highest level can make these mistakes. People who think very long and hard about how to make the right decisions can still make the wrong decision. And it doesn't mean they're bad at it or whatever.
Also, you can make every right decision possible and still have a, quote, bad or wrong outcome.
You can have an undesirable outcome. You can do everything right and still lose. So that little discussion out of the way, let's go ahead and dive into chapter 122, Leaving.
This entire back half of the Adem section, I think it's meant to make us feel like Quoth is in that defeat stage. What is the Joseph Campbell, like the stages of a narrative or a heroic narrative or what have you? Is there a thing that this lines up with?
This would be the belly of the beast. And I think also what this is, the thing that I keep coming back to is there's an element of grace to this. So what we saw last time was Quoth deciding to bare his soul, you know, and kind of let the chips fall where they may. And he makes a bold choice there to be vulnerable when every instinct in his body is screaming, protect yourself at all costs. And so his decision to play his lute in a way that flies in the face of all of the social conventions of the place that he's living, in the sense that he's having to be radically himself in a way that he wasn't before, without concern for propriety, without concern for consequences, without concern for being seen badly. He is accepting that as something that'll happen, but at least it'll be authentic. And I think we see kind of the denouement to that. So when Kvothe goes to Vashette, he's sure that his time here is at an end, and he's going to have to pack his bags and go, and is probably going to have to hurt some people on his way out the door.
So do you mean hurt as in emotionally hurt, or do you mean hurt as in physically hurt?
Potentially both. You know, we see that he makes a pretense of tripping over the door as a way to have to snag a piece of her hair so that he could use it in sympathy if he had to fight her off and escape. So when Kvothe gets in, he learns that he's not the first visitor for Vashette this morning. She's already received visits from Pentha, who spoke on Kvothe's behalf, and Carceret, who naturally has been speaking against him. And Vashette does a pretty good job of outlining what their general positions are and what the flaws in their positions are. While Pentha does see something in Kvothe, she doesn't know exactly why Vashette is angry with him. And while Carceret shares Vashette's anger with Kvothe, Carceret is just generally angry all the time. And so in kind of that broken watch that's right two times a day sort of way, it doesn't actually carry a whole lot of weight with Vashette. And so she asks, whose opinion do I actually trust in this matter?
And Kvothe answers, your own.
Because Kvothe understands that Vashette knows why she's angry with Kvothe. She knows the full scope of who he is and everything. And while it's not that Pentha's without wisdom, Pentha doesn't have the full scope of the issue.
I'd say that a lot of well-meaning and also not so well-meaning people tend to argue from a space of partial understanding far too much. We as a society have a terrible habit of not researching or not waiting until we have the full scope of a story before making up our minds about it.
I think that also fits into Vashette's diagnosis of Kvothe, which is, I think, pretty accurate, really, if we look at any single human being. She says, you are still a puzzle, gentle and troubling and clever and foolish, but someone who breaks a puzzle because they cannot solve it has left the Lathani. I am not such a one.
If you think about it, someone who breaks a puzzle in such a manner, it's like a kid who is trying to puzzle out something. More like a toddler, because once you get to like a curiosity age, you're going to potentially sit there for hours trying to figure out the puzzle. And it's almost a bell curve where you're going to get out of that curiosity age and again, brute force the puzzle. Just because you get the right answer doesn't mean that you did it right.
And just because you can't figure it out doesn't mean that the puzzle was wrong. And in this way, I think Vashette is showing a bit of wisdom and some grace. And she's recognizing that Kvothe is a complicated person. His gentleness and his troublingness, for lack of a better word, while they seem in opposition, don't really cancel each other out. They're both true.
I do want to touch back on the brute forcing. Sometimes it works. I've been in puzzle rooms, escape rooms, where because it's timed, sometimes the clever answer isn't the most efficient answer. And if a clever puzzle can be solved by just trying every combination, and it's very few combinations available, you just do that. I don't think that that is what Vashette would call of the Lathani, though.
No. So it's that bit of grace, though, saying that I've seen you for who you are in all of that, and I can't necessarily make sense of it, but it doesn't mean that you're defined by any one of these traits.
It does not mean that you're wrong or bad.
And I think that's actually kind of what love is. Like, if we think about love, you know, especially when we talk about it in the romantic sense, there's always sort of this period where you're putting on this version of yourself that you hope will be pleasing to the other person. And that's kind of that courtship phase. And once you're actually feeling safe, once you actually feel like it is okay to reveal who you really are, you know, all of those things that you put forward as your good parts, it's not that they're not a part of you, but they're not all of you. And it's when you are able to be this person who is troubling, this person who is troubled. Instead of presenting yourself as whole, it's presenting yourself as broken.
Or as true.
Right. I'm just going to say this. There is no way to present yourself as true that isn't broken. We're all broken in some fashion or another. And it's when we can accept those parts of ourselves and show those to the people that we love and care about and give them the opportunity to show us grace and love. Like, love is not just loving the person who is made whole, the person who is perfected themselves. That's easy. It's loving someone when they're broken, when they're hurting, you know, when they're at their lowest. And that's when it's most important. It's those times when you can say, I can't make sense of this person, and that's okay.
I don't love the idea of broken, because broken has such a connotation of fix me. I don't like that. I think it's more apt to say you can't love the whole person until they've been vulnerable.
Until you've seen their flaws.
I, again, don't like focusing it with words that have connotations of wrong or bad or negative. So that whole flaws thing. I don't know that I consider what you think is your flaw or flaws. I don't know that I see all of those as flaws, as bad, as something to be fixed or changed. If you have things that you have identified that you want to adjust or change about yourself, that's one thing. But I don't see others as a collection of their flaws. Traits, yeah. Sometimes I don't like traits of certain people. Sometimes I don't like traits of myself. But I don't want, personally, to view vulnerabilities as flaws, to view things that are different as flaws. You and I have some very particular accommodations that we have made to our home to help ease the rough edges of what we're supposed to have or supposed to do. Quote, we've made choices to accommodate the fact that we won't naturally do certain things. Easy example. We have a hard time with taking garbage out when it is overflowing. We have historically had such a hard time with that, that sometimes it winds up overflowing and spilling out and still doesn't get taken out. So what I did in our kitchen, I made it so that our trash can cannot overflow. It's not just that it has a lid. It is built into a cabinet that is like an inch clearance from the trash can lid. And it pulls out. And it can't overflow much. Can't get up to the top. And it can stink. But it can't, like, go for more than an hour or two after you've filled it up. You have to get it out of garbage can. You can't.
I think the other part of that is that because it pulls out, it's actually easier on my back.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes it easier for me to, one, put things into it, and I don't feel like I have to bend down and stoop to get down to it, which can be painful, especially on days when my back is feeling especially stiff.
Mr. 6'4".
Yes. And two, it makes it a lot easier to actually take it out. It's less work to do that part of it as well. So it's a double accommodation.
But to point that out, like, you could think that our unwillingness or inability to take the garbage out at a reasonable point would be a huge flaw. We found ways around it. Yeah, this is something that we have chosen ways to fix, but I think that if we give ourselves grace, we found solutions rather than focusing hard on the flaw.
I think the key is acceptance. And that means accepting some of the weird contradictions that are inherent in all people.
The thing about this that makes it an accommodation for us, but it doesn't necessarily work for other people, When we have other people, they have the hardest time remembering where we've put our trash can.
Yeah.
It works for us, but it's made a different weirdy in the heads of our friends.
This is true. It's that acceptance of the contradictions and the acceptance of the things that don't always make perfect sense. Knowing that there is more to the puzzle that we don't necessarily know, and being willing to accept that all of these things are true.
The next thing that we get is Vachette saying, bring your cloak along. We're going to go teach you how to fight in it. And all I have in my head at this moment is Watchmen.
Ah, yes. Dollar Bill.
Getting his cape stuck in the revolving door.
And then that, of course, inspired Edna Mode in The Incredibles with the whole no capes mandate.
And then that inspired a character in our current D&D campaign.
Indeed.
I gotta love it.
So with that, Kvothe returns kind of to his normal training routine, but it's only kind of the same.
There is a tension between him and Vachette now.
He's come too close to disaster.
Which is something that Will is setting up for me, because if we remember correctly, coat means disaster. Because everybody's theories and reading of a specific sentence that had coat and then something about disaster, the running theory that I know of throughout the community is that coat means disaster. Coat, of course, being Kvothe's kind of fake name, witness protection in Noir.
His alter ego.
Yeah. And this says, I had come too close to disaster. He lost a bit of himself being in Hert. He lost the core part of himself that brings him solace. His core vulnerabilities, his core self, really. His music. But of course, there was no music. Coat does not have music in him. Disaster does not have music in him. It's hiding away. It's shoving down. It's ignoring the things about oneself that make them oneself.
Yeah, I think the disaster that Kvothe has been facing here has been trying to make himself one of the Adem, which he was never going to be.
Changing oneself for others rarely works out in your favor.
And part of it is also, I think he has a fundamental misunderstanding of what the Adem are actually asking for from him. He thinks that they are asking him to become one of them, to totally assimilate, to leave behind who he is. But that's not exactly it. What they're really asking for him to do is to understand who they are. And when they are asking him to follow the Lathani, they are not asking him to conform to their norms. They are asking him to live authentically within their society in his own way and with a full understanding of what that entails.
To be honest, there's some stuff coming up that I think if I were going to write this story, or if I were Kvothe in this story, I'd have done something specifically different. And I'm going to talk about that when we get there. But I don't know if Kvothe ever gets to that authentic space while here.
I think he does very briefly, and we're going to get to that. I think if we look at the overall arc of Kvothe's story, he has a few moments where he is unabashedly himself and authentically himself. Like I say, though, it's not linear progression here. It's not like he has success and then everything else from there is just onward ever upward. There is some backsliding. There is regression. There is additional failure to be contended with across the board. And these moments of success don't mean that he succeeded. End of story. These are things that he's done well in this moment or in these moments. We'll discuss that more when we get to the next chapter. So we have sort of this return to normalcy.
And then the rug gets pulled out. The language used here, I think, it still ties into the lore around Kvothe. We have the flame, the thunder, and the broken tree. It came like lightning from the clear blue sky. This snap decision, at least to Kvothe's view, that it is time for him to take his test, to leave Hert one way or the other.
We learn that there's a little bit more to it than just, now you're ready. Shan has decided that she needs the test to happen before Kvothe has a chance to ingratiate himself with too many people in the community that might try to sway her judgment.
It's not even that they might try to sway her judgment. It's almost like letting someone get too close to a cow that's going to be their dinner in 2 days.
Yeah. Well, and it may not be even swaying judgment. It may be an outright rebellion.
I don't even know that it would be that far. I'm thinking that we're looking at it too small and too big. They might just like him and be sad if he's forced to leave or be mutilated. But at least if he's forced to leave, he's still alive. But bringing him in and letting him ingratiate himself with the community makes the community pine for more of his type of people. More exposure to different, to outsiders, to the outside world, to things that aren't of the Lothani.
So we know that Pentha got into a fight with Kar Saret over Kvothe, and Shallan has become quite fond of Kvothe as a friend and talks about him a lot with her friends.
Did you pronounce it a completely different way than normal?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't care.
Fair enough.
And then Vachette says there are others, and I think she's speaking of herself here.
So do I.
She is fond of him. She cares for him, even as she doesn't fully understand him. Even though there are parts of him that she finds troubling, she still cares for him. So then there's this question, am I ready? And the response is, that's not an easy question. Being invited to the school isn't merely a test of skill. It is a test of fit, of suitability. And for you, there will only be one chance. And ready or not, it is time. One of the things that I saw in this is that the Lothani is not about who you are when you've had all of the time to prepare to present your best face or whatever. The Lothani is about living your life authentically, especially when you aren't prepared. And it's this test of when you aren't prepared, how do you respond? You know, you can train yourself as best you can, but until you're actually put in a position where you have to actually use it without preparation, you're never going to know. Like, at a certain point, you kind of have to put it to the test. And that's what this is all about. If Kvothe knew when the time of the test was, he could prepare for it. He could do all of the things that he thinks he's supposed to do. But that wouldn't be a test of how he actually understands the Lothani. That would be a test of how well he understands the parameters of the test.
Much like standardized testing in current U.S. schools, you're not really learning the material, you're learning how to pass the test.
Exactly.
Now, I have one theory that may or may not come into play. I have a suspicion that there is something that's being set up with the whole man-mothers thing. I think there's going to be a little redheaded Adem at some point running around. And I'm not sure, but it's probably going to be Vachette's kid or Pentha's. But like, more likely at this point, I think there might be reasons why Vachette is like, okay, no, goodbye. Because they don't want fathers to be involved in child rearing.
Yeah.
They really don't.
And while the whole man-mothers thing may be something that some people believe, that many people believe, I have a hard time believing that Vachette, who has had a little bit more exposure to the outside world, believes.
Right. That, yes. I think it's much more likely that they take some form of herb to keep themselves from getting pregnant. I think that maybe they don't know the mechanism. Not everybody knows the mechanism this is causing. And maybe they're just so free with having sex whenever that when they decide that they want to have children, and they stop taking it. It just happens because the confluence of both things.
Law of averages says sooner or later.
Probably. I mean, chances are that there's still infertility in their society. And so I don't want to say like everyone gets the happy thing that they are hoping for or gets to reproduce when they're ready or that it happens automatically, because I think that that's an unrealistic thing to expect and also kind of cruel. But I think that it is very possible that Vachette, in her talkings with Cheyenne, may have revealed that she could potentially be pregnant. I think that that's a possibility. I don't think it's a certainty, but I think it's definitely a possibility that we are being set up for Foth to have fathered at least one kid while he's there, which is very problematic because I know how old he is. Anyway, there is a little tickle of a this is an impossible theory that I don't like that also exists. We don't know how far in the future from this the whole Waystone part of everything is. Do we know for certain that Coat is Quoth? We just know that he's red-haired.
Wow.
I'm just saying.
Okay, yeah, this isn't a Bat Country episode, so, but we'll...
We haven't done one of those in forever, and they're all on the Patreon, and they're all kind of...
I don't think anybody's listened to them.
If you have, let us know.
Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and move on to Spinning Leaf.
Yes. I don't really think that that's what we're being set up for, but it is definitely a Bat Country theory that popped into my head. Now, I think that it is more likely that there are children. I don't think that Coat actually is one of them.
Fair. Anyway, moving on.
I also don't think that Bast is.
Right.
Even though there have been people that are insistent on there being a connection between the Fae and the Aedim.
All right. So moving on to Spinning Leaf.
You're tickled. I love you.
I am. So the next morning, Vachette collects Quoth after breakfast, and Pentha gives Quoth a big hug of support.
I have to point out the whole wind thing. Carceret has been praying for a storm all night, but it's only gusting.
And Quoth doesn't really understand the significance of all of this.
Yet.
Yet. So Vachette takes him to warm up in their usual spot and then leads him to the Valley of the Sword Tree. And here Quoth realizes, of course, that's the name of the school. That's the basis of everything here.
That's their sacred tree.
Yeah, it makes sense that it would play a part in the test. Here's what he finds out. So at the center of the tree, around its trunk, there are several objects. And Quoth's task is to go in, choose one, and bring it out again. It's a test of many things. Pride, nerve, skill, and behavior. And of course, Quoth asks, what is the proper choice? To which the answer is, there are many proper choices and many more improper ones. It's different for everyone. The item you bring back reveals much. How you comport yourself reveals much. And it's sort of a not just what you do, but how you do it.
Quoth asks, what's stopping someone from crawling on their belly? Pride. Quoth, you're my student. Do you think that I will be proud of you if you crawl on your belly to do this? Do you think you will pass the test by taking the coward's way? That is not of the Lathani.
Then she also says, you know, you could just cover your face and kind of bulldoze forward because the direct route is oftentimes the quickest.
But brute forcing is also not of the Lathani, as we have just discussed.
And she's like, do you think I'd be proud of you for that? Do you think I've taught you to do that?
I mean, she gives him some safety tips. Don't let the leaves cut you across the neck or the face or the ear. We can't really reattach those.
But she does say that it's okay if it cuts you. The goal is not here to get out unscathed. That's kind of part of it. It's how you comport yourself when that happens. Are you going to be so afraid of making a single error that you are paralyzed by indecision?
I gotta say, that is so much more dangerous than going in with confidence. Think about the person who is going 20 miles under the speed limit on the freeway. They are so much more of a danger than someone going the speed limit, or at least going with the flow of traffic.
Yeah, with the flow of traffic is probably the better way to put it. But yeah, and of course, Cheyenne is not the only master present. There are masters from other schools who've traveled from afar to see the barbarian take his test. Foth deduces that this is not normal. And Vachette confirms that, yeah, Carceret probably had something to do with it, hoping that maybe the presence of the other masters is going to rattle Kvothe. Fortunately for Kvothe, this is giving him an audience. And that's actually kind of paradoxically the area where he's most comfortable.
If it were just by himself, if he were having to prove himself, I think, to himself and no one else, he'd be paralyzed with fear and indecision. He'd be second-guessing literally everything that he did. But with an audience, he is a showman.
It's the difference between just having sudden anxieties and doubts and jitters and nervousness.
Having the space for those.
And then also, like, he's used to that in the stage connotation. Pre-show jitters, that's kind of just something that he's used to at this point. And so when he feels a little bit of apprehension and then he realizes there's an audience, he's like, oh, I know how to handle this. I've handled this hundreds of times, thousands of times. I can do this. And it helps him work through that. It helps him accept it. And I think that acceptance is a large part of what he learns as part of this test. Because I think, honestly, when I look at this, this test is as potent as any lesson that he's learned up until this point in the entire saga. It's not just a test, it's something that teaches him more than anything he's learned. So, staring at the whirling branches and leaves of the sword tree, Kvothe finds his mind slipping into the emptiness of Spinning Leaf. And with his mind in this empty state, he can finally see the name of the wind written in the leaves of the sword tree. And he realizes that he could command the wind to be still or command it to a frenzy, but he realizes that he doesn't need to command it. He just needs to understand it. And with this knowledge, he's able to see where he needs to walk and find his path.
One thing to point out real quick beforehand, he gets an uneasy connection between this tree and the Cathay. I do think that there's a little bit of fey around the edges of the Adem, but that they're not necessarily inherently fey. I don't see the Cathay and the sword tree being literally the same thing, but they have a similar symbolism.
They're both about quantum patterns, almost.
They're also both a danger if you don't know how to handle them.
Here we see Kvothe seeing where the leaves are going to be, and he simply chooses to be different places.
I like how it says, I could choose to make them still, but that wouldn't be right.
Yeah. He is at this point finding harmony. This also really calls back to Vachette's lesson about the Lathani, which is it is about controlling yourself and the environment around you and the nature of whatever conflict or challenge you're facing. When he recognizes that he has the name of the wind on his tongue, that he can control what happens here and he can control himself. He's able to find a path in harmony with the wind, with the tree.
And he realizes that the way that he can act while in Spinning Leaf, while calling the wind, is very similarly deliberate and correct and patient in the way that Cheyenne fights. He's found that inner harmony, that peace. He doesn't need to fight right now. Literally going with the flow of the wind.
Yeah. He notes that it's not that Shan was quick. It's that she was exactly as quick as she needed to be in that moment. When she needed to be slow, she was slow. When she needed to be quick, she was quick. When she needed to be anything in between, she was right at that speed in between. Because that's where she needed to be. If we put it in music terms, right? You can play fast, you can play slow, you can play at a complex rhythm, or you can play at a simple rhythm. And the mark of skill for a musician is not that they play one way or the other. It's that they play at the speed they need to play with the consistency that they need to have for the song they're actually trying to play.
They need to be at the right tempo.
Exactly. So, using this revelation, Foth weaves his way to the center, the eye of the storm, the trunk of the tree. And there he's faced with some choices. So the first thing that he sees is a sword similar to Vachette's, made of an odd burnished gray metal without mark or blemish.
Very similar to Folly.
Yeah, I made that connection too. And I think maybe that, maybe where Cinder got his sword. Again, that whole Fae Chandrian connection to the Adem. I think there's something there.
Also, there's thoughts that Celatos is the Fae. I wonder if he has a connection to the sword tree.
It's entirely possible. It seems to fit with this idea that if you can see all of the patterns, you can make all the decisions. You can start pruning certain paths of reality.
Certain branches off of the timeline.
Yeah.
Are you calling the Cathay the TVA?
There's a certain element to that. Again, with that level of arrogance of assuming that the path that you have identified as the optimal is the one that ought to be and must be protected at all costs, regardless of the price paid by all other people. Yeah, there's definitely that level of arrogance and hubris and callous disregard for the lives of others. The next thing Quoth finds is a neatly folded red shirt, so the mercenary reds.
Something that, if he chose, could say that he'd like to be part of the school. Or it could also express hubris, thinking that he belongs to the school.
It could be seen as cultural appropriation. We've got an arrow with stark white fletching and a polished wooden cylinder of the sort that would hold a scroll.
The polished wooden cylinder and the scroll idea tickled my brain a little bit because it represents a certain type of knowledge, hidden knowledge. Things like you would find in the library, the archives, things that might lead to answers to the mysteries that Quoth has been searching to find out more.
This is also calling back to the ancient roots of the Adem people when they were initially master archers. That story of their origin, those hidden truths discovered by, oh, what were their names?
The beginnings of the school. Oh, dang it. I don't remember their names, but I know what you're talking about. I think our audience doesn't need us to go back and look.
We've also got a bar of gold, which... hey, that could mean your ability to bring back wealth for the school, or it could just be simple greed.
And Kvothe's first thought is that this could pay for him to go to the university indefinitely and never have to worry again. I think it's really easy to say that money does not solve all your problems when the system of living that we've got isn't capitalism. But it is capitalism, at least where we are. And both you and I have been in situations where we are behind the eight ball. I have been in almost the most dire circumstances when it comes to money. Both of us have been places where we have to count every penny. And both of us now are in a space where we don't. Money doesn't buy happiness, but oh my God, does it buy ease.
It makes a hell of a down payment.
You won't automatically be happier with more money, but you know what you will be? You'll be able to focus on literally anything else.
So it's natural that there would be a strong temptation for Quoth here, and not even out of greed.
I mean, think about the entirety of the story while he's at the university. Almost every other paragraph is about how he doesn't have the money to do something. And when you're living in that, when you are real life, actual person living in that, that is literally all you can do is focus on whether or not you have enough to reach the next milestone. And that could be a day, a week. That is exhausting.
He spent 3 years living on the streets of Tarbian, scraping and scrapping and trying to find just enough to make it to the next day. That wires your brain in certain ways. And it's not that he's greedy or anything like that, but it's that his brain has been wired to recognize that is survival. And to an extent, that's true, but it may not be the thing that he truly needs in this moment. Because remember, while he's in Edemre,
he wants for nothing.
Right. Gold isn't really going to do a whole lot for him. It'll only weigh him down. The next thing we find is a piece of silk hanging from a low branch. I think that symbolizes comfort. That symbolizes luxury.
There's another sword, more ordinary. So maybe the idea of going back to his home to fight, he's accepting the sword or taking the sword that is here. Again, I do think that it might actually have been folly. It says, I want to take something of this culture back with me to use as a weapon.
Yeah, there's a sense of arrogance to it.
But the more ordinary sword indicates violence still.
We've also got a tarnished vintage halfpenny. Not sure exactly what that calls to mind.
So the vintage coin calls to mind Ventus, where he had just been sent from, probably at least like half a year ago or something. Few months at least. And almost feels like being tied monetarily to that space.
It's old money, literally.
Yes.
We have a long, flat whetstone, dark with oil, which could be symbolizing constant vigilance.
Or constant improvement, but maybe improvement and working hard to the detriment of usefulness, almost. Because if you overuse your whetstone, if you grind too much off, your blade becomes brittle or too thin to be of use.
There's also a small book with a brass lock.
Again, with the lock, hidden knowledge, hidden or hard to find, hard to unlock.
There was also a spindle of gray woolen thread. I think that speaks to potentially the presence of anonymity, the ability to live your life just blending into the crowd.
There's also three blue flowers tied with a blue ribbon. I think that that almost represents a femininity or like settling down or going towards a softer, almost feels like Denna.
A little bit, yeah.
Like a beauty because it's blue.
Right.
Like a wanting to experience romantic love.
There is also a smooth round stone sitting on a clean white cloth. That could be a sling stone or just something that's smoothed away from all worry. And finally, Kvothe's lute in its case.
And this last thing, the lute, breaks him out of Spinning Leaf. It shatters his calm. And it's because of the betrayal of the social contract of this belongs to me. This was in my room. You violated my space and you violated my things. And I know what the Adem think of people who play music. You are telling me that you see me as nothing more than a whore.
Yeah. And it's also this recognition that that part of himself is something that he should be hiding, is what he's feeling in that moment of anger.
And I don't think that that's their intent at all.
No. I think they are saying you need to accept that this is a part of who you are.
And if you choose this, that is a valid choice. Everything here is a valid choice.
And all of this anger, the fact that suddenly the control and calm that he'd felt is gone, it brings back a lot of that anxiety. And he starts really stalling for time.
He circles the tree once, twice, three times, trying to figure out what to do in this moment. He weighs all of his options, what all of them mean, whether he needs to be seen as giving, and if that could be taken as greedy, if he needs to be seen as patient, but that could be twisted into a way that is impatient. And this brings me to what I would have done differently. Because I think that the chapters we covered way back in the 8th episode of our entire pod series, the space where Kvothe had nothing, his family had been killed, he was alone in the woods with musical instruments and that's about it, with his solace, with his self, with the things that make Kvothe Kvothe, and nothing more. No audience, no comfort, except for his father's lute. I think, to me, it would have been more powerful if he had sat at the base of the tree, taken his lute out, played it, and put it away. I would have probably, if I were writing this story, done that just because I feel like that would be such a gut punch. I think that the rest of this section is very beautiful, and maybe it doesn't need that, but I think it would be a benefit.
Well, let's circle to the universe of the actual, the one that actually happens in this story. What happens next is kind of objectively funny. Not even kind of, it is objectively funny.
Well, this story has been woven and has captured you and enthralled you. Just the way that the wind and the events surrounding everything right now has captured Kvothe. And he realizes he needs to pee.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a fact of life. Sometimes you really gotta go.
And when you gotta go, sometimes the where do I go pops into your head. And in this case, the funniest thing that Kvothe could think of, what would everybody here think if I just walked up to the tree and took a leak?
And in that moment of absurdity,
laughter bubbles up. And I think that's another form of wind.
It takes the wind out of his anger. It deflates that anxiety that's been spinning and growing and bubbling within him. And he kind of realizes that no matter what I choose here, it can't be worse than peeing on their sacred tree.
There is no wrong answer. I don't have to overthink this.
And it's enough to help him regain his calm. At that point, he kind of speaks the name of the wind, but it's not in a commanding sense. It is the way you say the name of an old friend.
Previously, he's had such a hard time recalling the name of the wind after it's left, after it's shattered. And this time it comes with ease and gentleness.
It kind of feels here less like he is commanding the wind to be still than that he is speaking to the wind in a gentle fashion, and the wind is meeting his energy in kind. So it is matching his gentleness.
It's almost a loving gesture.
Again, it's not him commanding it. It is him meeting it. And as both of their emotional states gentle, both his and the wind, it goes still.
And he's able to walk out unscathed, bringing nothing with him.
He does one final gesture on his way out. He takes his left hand, his fretting hand, and brushes it up against one of the sharp leaves, allowing the blood to well up. He approaches Shan and then extends his left hand, bloody palm up, and closes it into a fist, a gesture meaning willing. And what's interesting to me is that bloody hand imagery matches the Aemir. Shayan nods, showing acceptance.
After a long moment, Shayan nods. I think that that's important.
I think part of it is also that Shayan wants to give this the space in her mind that it deserves, to really evaluate it, and not only that, but see how Kvothe accepts that pause.
If he's impatient, if he doubts himself.
How certain is he? How willing is he truly? This is him submitting to her judgment, accepting it for what it is, regardless of what the answer is. This is Shan testing his resolve in this, and she accepts it and gives that nod, at which point Kvothe relaxes and the wind returns to its original state. So with that, I think we're in a good spot to actually transition to our friend Nemos. So for the past 106 episodes that we've spent discussing first the name of the wind and now the wise man's fear, our running bit has been that our model of practical wisdom is never Kvothe. But here on the 107th episode, I'm going to break format and declare that for once, it is Kvothe.
It's Kvothe?
Yes.
I didn't know that you were going to choose Kvothe.
It's not that he's perfect or that he does everything right. But the Lathani is not about revealing your perfection, but revealing your vulnerability, your authenticity, your whole self. And when faced with the test of the sword tree, Kvothe recognizes that each of the objects presented as things to bring back represent things that hide intent, that leave room for misinterpretation. They're about trying to present a message to others that they may interpret in ways you never intended, because fundamentally that's using the object as a stand-in for yourself. He realizes that oftentimes the choices explicitly presented to us do not represent the sum total of choices available.
This is a huge thing I've been thinking about lately.
There is a lot of times where choices are presented as sort of a multiple choice sort of thing.
There's an either or.
Right. Pick A, B, C, D, or E.
They're mutually exclusive. You can't have both. You can't have multiples. You can't choose something that's not on this list. And again, this is something that's been playing through my mind. A way to kind of help guide someone through a decision that is literally like, I've made you a bunch of business cards, choose one, is to not give a myriad of answers. You don't give them 10 options. You give them at most 3, sometimes 2. I usually choose 3 because then there's kind of the thing that can be instantly thrown out as a no, or that you will instantly hone in on. But, and no slight against anyone, any family, anything, but it struck me when we went to visit your family in Montana 1.5 years ago, when everyone would provide a whole bunch of options for your little niece of what she could do. She had her own view of what she wanted to do, and everyone kept giving her option after option after option after option, which tells you what's expected from other people and blocks out your ability to just sit and think and find your own solution. Feeling like you are being pressured into a decision and not given space to think, I think leads to rash decision making and dissatisfaction with the final result more often than not. I think that that is a detrimental way of having to think, to come to conclusions, to decide. I think that when you are bombarded with option after option after option, and none of them are quite right, we are training people by bombarding them with questions that they have to choose something that others would want them to do. But I think that there is wisdom in letting people choose for themselves.
The other thing I found was that his choice to go back empty-handed signifies that the thing he found at the trunk of the sword tree was himself, wounds and all. So instead of bringing back a thing that adds another layer of abstraction between the self and the rest of the world, he just brought back himself. He's basically saying, judge me by what you see of me, not these objects that hide who I am. We're not our objects. We are not our possessions. We are not our job titles. We are not our wealth. We are not our comforts.
Our hobbies.
Right. As part of this, he's found a greater boon than any item. He's found the thing he's been chasing since he was a child, the name of the wind. All of these other things just get in the way. And that bloody hand represents the willingness to sacrifice to achieve his goals. I mean, let's think about this. Like, the thing that he's been afraid of more than anything else is any injury to his hands. And here he is willingly allowing a wound to happen greater than anything that he has allowed to happen to his hands before.
I'm going to say this. I have cut my pinky on my fretting hand. This isn't the mechanism that bends. It was the tip of my pinky, which isn't strictly necessary. You can mostly get away without using a pinky, especially for more beginner songs. And it has taken months for it to stop hurting when I hit it against a string. Like, if I press a fingernail into where that cut was, it still kind of hurts. He cut his palm where you rest the neck of the lute, where you would bend to be able to reach your fingers to all of the strings on the neck. On the hand that does the most individual finger movements, the most stretches, the most bending, the most just nuance.
He is not his hands. He is not his lute. He is not any of these things that he has previously identified as core to his being. He does not have knives for hands. He has hands. And he accepts that he's willing to sacrifice to show who he is. Then he submits himself to accept the judgment of Shan without fear or apprehension because he's accepted his judgment of himself. He's looked at himself and said, this is who I am. I accept it. And I can accept whatever decision you make now. And in this moment, he's finally living authentically without fear or pretense. Now, I want to note, because again, our theme is non-linear progression, says nothing about him continuing to be our Phronimos. But in this moment, he's earned it.
I will say that I don't disagree with you, and that to my memory, he does go through non-linear progression or regression.
Yeah, exactly. But that said, sometimes our models aren't eternal. No model is eternal. Every person that we look to as, you know, a model of who we want to be, they're going to make mistakes. They're going to have bits of imperfection in their lives because we're all human, regardless of, you know, what kind of status we're ascribing to them in our minds. And so we don't need our Phronimos to be perfect. We just need to be able to find moments of that perfection, even if they're fleeting, that we can learn from.
I'll say this also. This won't be a situation the way that Vachette has been our Phronimos over and over again, or Tempe has been our Phronimos over and over again. Kvothe at this moment is having a flash of wisdom. And I think that you chose well.
Thank you. So with that, let's go ahead and discuss our thing of the week. It's your turn. What'd you pick?
There's a few things that have kind of rattled around in my head, but they all come back to this same theme almost. So there's a part of me that wants to say, push yourself out of your comfort zone. And then there's a part of me that wants to address it just a little bit differently, as in, don't let your comfort zone become like the swamp of sorrow. Don't let yourself become Artax, sinking ever further into the comfort of the familiar.
I think sometimes comfort can be a trap.
Excessive comfort can be a trap. So this is kind of inspired actually by Pat Rothfuss. Yesterday he did a book signing in St. Louis. It was kind of a pop-up event that wasn't really telegraphed, announced, anything. He just decided to do it. At least that's from what I've gathered. I saw an announcement on Facebook about it. I saw a few people posting about it on Reddit and about on the Facebook groups that I'm in for the Kingkiller Chronicle. And the thing that struck me is the juxtaposition between how I've seen him look on his Twitch streams recently-ish versus how he looked at the signing. He's always had the big bushy beard, and he's always kind of had the unkempt hair and what have you. But the term letting yourself go, I think, is horrible. But he looked like he had allowed himself to continue the comfort in the way that it becomes like a mud pit.
It's nice to wear sweatpants once in a while, but when the only thing you ever wear is sweatpants, it can be constricting.
It's nice to not have to trim your beard constantly, but once you've let it go for 4 months, it's time to give it a trim and a reshaping. We call it a depression beard when you don't ask to have it trimmed back by the time that it's getting in your mouth when you're eating or whatnot. And the same thing goes for like clothing, like you said, if you just go for the thing that's the most comfortable all the time. You can find things that look good on you that are comfortable. It doesn't have to be pajama pants 24/7. And so to that point, you and I just recently got kilts that fit. I have had a kilt, been a little bit not the right fit for me, and so I haven't worn it for that reason, but also for the reason of it's a step out of my comfort zone. It's not instantly comfortable societally because it's unusual, unless you're in like a convention or a Ren Fair, which I fully plan on wearing my kilt to the Ren Fair. But our friend who has worn his kilt around us also said that it's a little difficult societally to be a guy in a kilt. And so it's useful and helpful for the two of us to also wear kilts around him. It helps normalize things, but it's a step out of all of our comfort zones. I think it's important to recognize that a step out of your comfort zone doesn't have to be a massive change. mean, my next thing also, again, clothing. I am a jeans and t-shirt person, or sometimes cargo pants and t-shirt person. Mostly fandom t-shirts. And some of those have aged like sour milk. They're not relevant any longer, but the t-shirt's still good, so I still wear it, you know? I've made a shift. Not a huge shift, but a little shift. To having more of my graphic tees be less fandom specific. Also to wearing button-up short sleeves over them because I like the look of that. It's things that I don't trust myself to style well, but I want to do them. Moving outside of what I would normally do, I've spent time making little amigurumi turtle ducks, and I've made a few amigurumi before, but this is the first time where I've really just gone for it and made my own pattern and decided to do things the way that I think would work, and they worked. You know, I've done a real life pickup group for D&D recently in the last year. That's not something that was strictly the most comfortable thing because they were people that I didn't know, and now we're good friends. You know, you're going to step out of your comfort zone this week. You're going to be playing a concert. I'm so excited for you.
To be fair, I'm only playing one song at a concert, but I am actually playing in front of other people, which is new for me. Like, that's just not something I typically do. But yeah, I think that's a really good thing of the week to recommend. So with that, why don't we go into our seven words?
You have seven words from the book?
I do. I had a number of choices. First, I've got, she knew I was angry with you. Then I've got, gentle and troubling and clever and foolish. Have, I would not have enjoyed leaving Hert. I have, leave that here or people will talk. I had come too close to disaster. You aren't telling me the whole truth. I have, so this is a test of nerve. It is a test of many things. I have, the straightest line is quickest after all. I have, but what does that reveal of you? Are you a bull that charges blindly? I have, not quickly, though sometimes she was quick. And then I have the actual sentence that I picked, which is, and ready or not, it is time. I just feel like that hits that sense that life doesn't always wait for us to be fully ready or to be what we think is fully ready. At a certain point, you know, we have to trust our instincts and our training, and we have to go because it's not going to wait for us. And you have to accept that sometimes you're as ready as you're going to be and just be ready to adapt and roll with the punches. Life isn't going to wait for you.
You can't consider every option forever.
Yeah. The choice not to decide is also a choice. So with that, it's time for seven words from life. It's your turn. What'd you pick?
All right. So I mentioned that you were going to be playing in your concert. I know it's a student concert. I know that it's kind of low stakes, which is probably for the best, but I think you're going to be great. And my seven words are, I'm so excited to see you play.
Oh, that's really sweet. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm excited to see how it goes.
You have a practice today.
Yep.
With the people you're going to be playing with.
For the first and only time.
Oh, well.
So with that, I'd like to thank you for potting with me.
Thank you for potting with me.
And thanks for listening to Tales from the Waystone. Join us next time on Tales from the Waystone as we discuss chapter 124 of The Wise Man's Fear through the lens of the line of history.
We would like to thank our friend Shawnee Jang for our theme music.
And many thanks to Patrick Rothfuss for creating a world that we've enjoyed exploring.
Audio production, editing, and social media coordination, courtesy of me, Phoenix McCullough.
And writing and project management, courtesy of me, Will McCullough.
If you would like to help support us, please head on over to Patreon, and you can be a free member over there, you could be a paid member over there. Any way is good, but if you want to listen to our ramblings about the Sandman, there's also a tier where you can get some of that. There's some things where you can kind of encourage me to do art, things of that nature.
You can also come hang out on our Discord server. Mostly it's memes right now, but you know, we're always open for a chat here and there. We check it fairly regularly. So with that, here's to one more day above the roses.
To one more day above the roses.
Ding!
Did you mean the line doesn't always go up?
No, I specifically worded it that way.
Can you explain why?
Yeah. In financial circles, the phrase line go up is sort of a way to mock the expectations of investors for what they expect of companies.
Oh.
But line go up means good. Line go up. Line doesn't always go up.
That's adorable and I love it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
We won't go into explaining that on the pod, though.
We just did.
You can cut it.
Why?
I don't like explaining jokes.
I'm the editor.
Okay.